the date, isn't it? Next Tuesday? The 9th, yeah.
So don't forget the vocab quiz next Tuesday. Grammar, well, translation next Thursday.
We didn't quite finish this one. We've got just the last paragraph to do, and then we'll get into lesson 37. Okay. Okay, we want to finish up here on lesson 36. We've got one more paragraph to do in the reading here, so we should go through it to make sure everybody has the information. And we're starting with this last line, Vayomer Yosef, and that'll finish this out. So, let's see. I'll try to find a good stopping place here. There really aren't any good ones, but... Okay, maybe we either have to go... Well, I guess the only real natural pause is the first comma in that line. After... Amten, yeah. So, who's up next? Anybody?
I just had read the last one.
Okay. John, I put you up in the hot seat. So start with Vayomer Yosef down there.
Vayomer Yosef hu asher amarti alechem lemor meraglin.
Yeah, meraglin.
Bezot. Elchan Etkem.
Atem? Or no, you went further on. Huh? Yeah, Etkem. Okay. That's all right. Let's see.
That's where the... Oh, I see.
Yeah, there was a comment before that. Yeah. No, that's fine. That's fine. Why don't you stop there? You just kind of have it in the middle of a sentence and...
Joseph spoke a fact, which I spoke to you, saying, you are spies, that I will test you, or in that I will test you.
Yes, it's going to have to kind of come idiomatic here almost. He gives down here, footnote 9, this is so a fact, and the asher clause is the subject. So it's almost as that. The way I said it was, so that which I have spoken to you, saying you are spies, is a fact. Or so a fact it is, that which I have spoken unto you. See, the asher is that which I have spoken to you, saying you are spies. That's that whole asher clause. And so this who is there, you know, it is a fact which I have spoken unto you, saying you are spies. Something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you're asserting the truth of this thing. So that's kind of the idea. So I said, and Joseph said, so that which I have spoken to you, saying you are spies, is a fact. I just worded it that way just because the English should be more appropriate.
What liberty do we have on these tests? Can you get a phrase like that?
Well, I'm obviously going to be more lenient on something like that, because if you do it in a literal word-for-word fashion, it may not make any sense. So I want to see not only that you saw the literal meaning of the words, but also that you understand what the mechanism is. So... when in doubt, you may put down a literal rendering and then put in parentheses what it, you know, a good translation of it is that gets the idea across. So always feel at liberty to do it a couple ways if you're not sure. So that way I can see that your problem was just trying to express it. It wasn't that you didn't get the idea of the Hebrew. Main thing I'm going to be looking for when I look at a translation is, did you catch the functional use of the words in the sentence and so forth? And if your translation reflects that, you know, it may not be, you know, some of these things, it's a matter of judgment. What's the best translation? But if I can see that you got the idea, then I'm, you know, pretty well satisfied. Okay. Then, you do have this other phrase too. I guess you went ahead and read the next phrase. So, Bezoth. and you know, to the next comma there. Bizoth, ev. What is it? Efkan, efkem. What would that be translated?
In that I will test you.
Yeah, in this I will test you. Bizoth, it would be this. In this I will test you. Okay, and then the rest of it comes. So in this I will test you or examine you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the feminine form for this rather than that. Okay, and then the rest is, let's see, how far should we go there?
Why is it feminine?
Oh, sometimes it is feminine, sometimes masculine. You might see bezet or bezoth. Yeah, it, I don't know. I've never really discovered a pattern to that. So they use them both ways. It's curious. You know, I'd kind of like to see a pattern, but I haven't been able to discern one yet. So if anybody has a revelation.
Well, the most fact is this isn't referring back to anything.
Well, in this will I test you. Yeah, it's coming up, you know. In this will I test you, and then his statement is going to be the test. So it's an introductory statement as to what the test is going to be. So in this, you know, this that I'm about to say.
The fact that he called them spies. I'm going to test you.
Oh, yes.
They are. So it's, yeah. It's kind of...
Yeah, in this you're saying that you're spies. Yeah, that's the issue.
Yeah.
That whether they're spies or not. And that's a possibility. You could take it as referring back to what he just said, or you could take it as referring forward to what he's about to do as the test. So I don't think that the fact that it's feminine is going to help you one way or another, though. Mm-hmm. All right. So starting with Chai Faro there, or Chai Faro, who's that next? Tony, do you want to take it? You want to take a... You're going to pass? Okay. Tony's on audit. That's why he's got the option. So if you... You know, he's going to try to... He's right now he's been swamped with a grad thing, and so he's not quite as up on this, so I told him he could pass. And if you want to, we'll give him a little grace, you know. Okay.
In Babu Akhikam Hakaton Hina Shilhu Mifem Echad Vika F Akhikam Vatam.
Yeah, well, why don't you stop there with the Vatam? We'll have someone pick that one up. So just stop with that Achichem there, that'll be fine. Okay.
You shall not leave here unless your small brother comes here.
Mm-hmm.
Then from you one, and he will take your brother.
Okay. Okay, that's fine. You might, yeah, you might use a Jussive translation for that. Let one of you send. Send one of you and let him bring. Just because you started with an imperative and you continue with imperfects, you often get this Jussive idea. So that's probably the way I would render it, is a Jussive.
And let him bring.
Yeah, and let him bring. Let him bring your brother. Okay, and you. I guess you went on here. No, wait. That was as far as you went. Yeah. Okay. Send. From one of you. See, that is what it literally says. Send from one of you, but obviously, you know, send one from among you. In other words, send from you one. So send one of you, and let him bring your brother. Probably be the best way. Yes?
Is the younger brother coming in part? I need to hear that.
Okay, all the earlier part? Okay. Well, we'll go back to As Pharaoh Lives here. As Pharaoh lives, you shall not leave here unless your youngest brother comes here. This is key M here. You shall not unless.
Okay.
See, it's that idiom of M plus key M.
Okay, I had trouble with it. I can't find the sense there in Hebrew, but...
Bo.
Is that
bo
with a preposition in on it?
Let's see. Let me check what I've got here.
Right? Yeah.
Unless. Your youngest brother comes here. Okay, your brother comes. Yeah, it's probably a participle.
He's coming, that's what I have.
Yeah, unless it's coming, your youngest brother, unless your younger brother comes. Mm-hmm. And then the preposition, but yeah, unless the in the coming of your...
I had unless in comes mm-hmm. your younger brother hither.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Now, don't think of it in so much as coming into some place or coming in, but probably unless in the coming of your brother. In other words, you're not going to do this unless it's in the state of the coming of your youngest brother, and the idea there.
And that is the term participle?
Participle? I think it's participle or an infinitive construct. Did you check that? Okay. It's one or the other. And sometimes the form may be the same on those.
That helps, that's all I need.
Okay. Anyone else? All right. John, did you have any? Okay.
How do we get behind the future idea?
Yeah, because it's conditional. See, the unless there, the whole clause is setting up a conditional framework. And so that's appropriate to the use of either infinitives or participles or imperfect forms are typical in this kind of construction.
So are we looking at a predication here then? In a way, and then we
can't rephrase it in English. Well, in a way, yes. If we take this as, if this is a participle, let's see, I think it's probably an infinitive. It looks like an infinitive.
Well, they don't show it with the whole and while any place in here.
They don't. Okay.
B7E. So that's
probably
the unusual form of it.
Yeah, this is the longer form, and that was the defective form, no doubt, because it is from a hollow verb.
But if you're going to look at it that way, it could be the imperative, or it could be the passive participle, or
yeah, it could be just about anything. Take what you want. Yeah, infinitive construct sounds the best to me with the preposition be on it. That's what you normally see, but be or le. You know, infinitive construct. So my guess is infinitive construct.
Even the passive participle, does that ever take the...
Yeah, well, the trouble with a passive participle would be...
Will be coming, you know...
Well, yeah, a passive participle could take... let me think now. Usually it's infinitives that are using those the and the combinations. Participles usually are, you know, adjectival, and they're just modifying a noun. They're pretty much just either slave to a noun or stand as substantives. If they stand as a substantive, you might see a preposition on them like that. But you have to have a substantive function for it. In the one coming, or, you know, the one coming, or that type of thing. The one who has come if it was passive. No, that wouldn't even be passive. That would just be a perfect idea. You wouldn't have this verb in a passive form, so. So that would probably solve that one. What's that?
Yeah, this
is okay. Does he give the full paradigm for it?
Yeah.
Does he give a passive participle for it? Does he list it?
I see the form there, though.
Oh, he has it with the whole and while. Okay. Oh, okay. Does he call it a gerund?
Yeah.
Okay, that would probably correspond to infinitive construct then.
Well, coming.
Mm-hmm, coming, something like that, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh, that's normally what you see. It's the infinitive construct that uses those prepositions normally. Yeah. So that's the way I would analyze it, too. Once you get used to it, it'll probably be... Let us know after you've used it a while what you think of it. Modern Hebrew? Good.
Sure.
Right. One of those cryptic books. Oh, yeah, okay. Uh-huh. Right. Well, if you ever go to Israel, you know, you have a modern... Yes.
I just remembered that you were supposed to make an announcement for Pete.
Oh, I haven't made it yet, but Pete, if you're listening. and just to clarify for everybody. Yeah, late bulletin here. We, on the translation tests, make sure you remember we're going from Hebrew to English, not from English to Hebrew, so you won't be composing Hebrew. And what you'll be doing is I'll hold you responsible for those four, the readings, you know, the readings in those four chapters, and you'll get a selection of that. You won't have to translate them all, but you won't know which ones you'll get, so in effect you need to be able to translate them all. So that's why it's important to go through and make sure you get it down right the first time through here. Okay. Then the last phrase here, well, picking up from Achichem there, the last word in the second to last line, Vu'atem, start with that. Doug, are you next? Or Pete? Okay, Pete, you haven't done it? Okay, Pete, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. It's short. Okay. Yeah, you left after brother there. Bring your brother. Okay, and you. Mm-hmm.
And you will stay here, and I will try your words whether truth is with you, and if not, as Pharaoh lives, you are spies.
Right. Exactly. Good. Yes, and you will remain here, and I will test your words whether truth is with you, and if not, as Pharaoh lives, you are spies. Okay. Good. And there's what he calls this assertive use of key here in footnote 11. As Pharaoh lives, you are spies. So it's almost gets almost a demonstrative feel to it. As Pharaoh lives, that you are spies. You know, I mean, as Pharaoh lives, it is verified that you are spies. Something like that. Maybe you could think of it to try to get a key idea in there. But it's an idiomatic usage of it. Okay, any questions beyond that?
How is that about the, how did you do that with, I will test them your words?
Oh, okay, I will test your words. Yes. Well, let's see, he starts out with, and the words, and your words, I will test, and then footnote 10 here is, this ha is indicate whether. So your words I will test whether truth, you know, if they are true. See, whether truth and then if Cam is with you. So your words I will test whether truth is with you. Okay, and that ha there is the point of this footnote 10, is that ha is indicating that it's an indirect question. You see, we've seen ha as an interrogative. And so I will question whether or if truth is with you. So if you made it a direct question, it'd be, is truth with you? And then if you make an indirect question, I will test whether truth is with you. So it's an indirect question. Okay.
And that's great.
And then im lo, and if not?
If not.
Okay. As Pharaoh lives, chai faro. And then the key is that idiomatic usage. And then miragalim. Ethem, or Atem, you are spies. And the key is adding a punch to that. And it's a little bit hard to translate, perhaps, literally. As we've seen key as because or that, kind of like hoti in Greek. But now, in this case, a literal translation wouldn't fit. Huh? Yeah, in a way it is. The fact that, something like that. Yeah. This, that. Mm-hmm. It's got a substantive, powerful. Again, it's better felt than felt. But that one you might not catch the first time you read it. Okay. Derived verbs, lesson 37. Finally got there. Although we're going to be there for a while, as you'll see. If you can see the scenario here on the chapters written there on section 139 at the bottom. We're going to be covering Niphal in lessons 37 to 39, Piel and Pual in lessons 40 to 42, Ifiel and Hophal in lessons 43 and 49 to 49. It's quite a section. and hit the pile in less than 50. There'll be other things in those lessons too, but they're going to, you know, split this up so we can feed it to you a piece at a time.
I've seen polo.
Yes.
Before. Now that I figured that must refer to participle.
No, it's actually poel, and there's also hith polel, and some things like this that are deviant forms of these same verbs. You know, they're additional forms of it for verbs that get really irregular, or you know, ones that are so messed up that they can't even fit this pattern. You know, see these words, nifal, pl, pual, hithiel, hofal, hithpael, are actually built from the verb pa'al, yeah, and so they're actually the forms of those of the verb pa'al, and you just transliterate them over in English and you call them that. Now there are some verbs that don't follow that pattern. You get two lamas, verbs that have two lamas, they'll be hith polel, for example, and you'll get slight, you know, if the vowel points or something changes enough where it's worthy of making another category, they'll do that. So you just can consider them deviant forms of the same thing. Meaning-wise, the pattern's pretty well set here, and then pronunciation-wise, there will be some various patterns. I'm not sure if he even gets to that in this book or not.
Or I think poel, pl, or poel type or something?
Yes, poel would be the same as a pl, but with a colon type sound to start it, and that's the major difference. I was just trying to see if he dealt with this thing in his book at all. We may have to check some other books to get information on that. I can't remember what we... Oh, yeah.
Analytical and Eusebius.
Yeah, and then you wonder what that is. Sure. If he doesn't cover it, I'll just have to dig out a list. I thought he did, but maybe he doesn't. I'll have to dig out a list of those and then show you the correspondence and so forth if you ever run into him. But that won't be too difficult once you've seen the basic pattern. Well, yeah, there's polel and polal. Hith polel in... Lesson 51. Okay. Section 180, page 280, 253, bottom of the page. Polel, polal, and hith polel. In place of pl, pual, and hith pl, verbs from hollow roots, there is a derived system of verbs characterized by the reduplication of the final root consonant and colon in the first stem syllable. So these are just functioning in the place of those for hollow verbs. And then there's poel. Okay, other verb types, section 181 here. That's where we found it. We've got poel, palal, pilpel. So these are... poel is similar to the polel of the preceding paragraph, but formed from regular triliteral roots. So this is something that happens on regular triliteral roots, but it gets the same kind of pattern. And its meaning would be akin to a pl. And then palal, presumably from triliteral roots, with the reduplication of the final roots consonant, still the same meaning. Pilpel, perhaps traceable to reduplicated biconsonantal hollow roots. So that's the problem, just these complications with the kinds of roots and vowel patterns that are being used. But you don't see very many of those in comparison to the others, so that's why they just dealt with in a short chapter here. Okay, it was in there, I thought it was, but I couldn't remember where. All right, derived verbs then. Let's introduce what this is all about, because all you've got now is a bunch of funny words. All of the verbs studied in the preceding lessons belong to the conjugational type known as kal, or the simple conjugation. Since each consists analytically of an unaugmented root plus a stem pattern, perfect, imperfect, etc. Unaugmented means there's nothing that's been attached to the root. Anything that's attached to it in the paradigm is only a person number suffix or prefix or something like that that's indicating that information in the conjugation. But in Hebrew, as in most languages, other verbs may be constructed from these same roots, mainly by the use of prefixal elements or modification of the stem patterns. Now, some of you, I think, the Greek students are familiar with the fact that you can take certain verbs in Greek and put a preposition on them, maybe even a couple prepositions on them, and affect the meaning of them. And so you're really taking the same root idea of the verb, but you're putting prepositions to get a little bit different nuance of meaning and so forth. And Tony went through a presentation on meno that way, you know, and getting sun meno and ek meno and, you know, these meno, so forth, various from the same idea. Well, this is akin to that kind of thing, although there's a certain consistent pattern here that you don't necessarily see in Greek. You're getting more verbs out of the one verb you had by using a certain set of morphemes or a system of morphemes that will give you certain consistent meanings. There are six important types of derived verbs. are often called conjugations. So these are derived verbs because they're derived from the simple call forms. And so you have the same three radical core to it, but you've added something to it. And then you've added something to it even before you've added the suffixes and so forth for the conjugation. And that something has affected the meaning. Not all roots occur in all six forms. Just as many roots are not employed as verbs in the call, although they are well attested in nouns and adjectives. You see, there will be some verbs that you may find only in the PL, for example, and there's no call form at all. And so you look it up in the dictionary, and they'll give you the PL form. Or some of the dictionaries will just give you a no vowel points at all, just the three consonants, and then tell you, you know, if you see one with no vowel points at all, it's a pretty good hint that it doesn't occur in call. And that's one of the ways they'll show that. And then they'll maybe say something, occurs only in PL and Hithfield or something.
In your experience, is it because of the nature of the verb, or is this...
Sometimes it is because of the nature of the verb. Sometimes it's just it's an intensive verb already, you know, and there's no other portion to it. Perhaps in other cases it may be that there was a verb, but people being as emotional as they are, they're always using the intensive form anyway, and then pretty soon the other one drops out. So that's a possibility too. Sometimes it's just the meaning of the verb. Sometimes you know even though PL is the intensive, sometimes you really can't see it obviously because you don't have another verb to compare it to, and so you just kind of take it the way it is, and you really don't know that there was another verb that it was derived from. So that's about the best you can do. But in general, if you've got a call form and you put it in PL, it'll do certain thing to it, a certain reasonably consistent thing to it. There's lots of exceptions, so. And it may not be really exceptions. It may just be that we're not really perceiving how and what sense the thing was intensified. That sometimes happens. Okay. The six principal derived types are named by the Hebrew grammarians according to the form they would assume in the third person masculine singular of the perfect with the root pa'al. So that's where these things come from the verb pa'al, which means what it means to do or make, something like that. And that verb was chosen. Now, I mentioned to you earlier, I think, in the systems that you'll in some books you'll see a different system for describing verb types. We've been using, you know, one guttural, two guttural, three guttural. Some systems use, you know, pay aleph, you know, it'd be a one aleph. Because pay, they use the letter pay to represent the first position, the letter ayin to represent the second position, and the letter lamath to represent the third position. So a lamath hay verb would be a three hay, that we even call a three hay. Lamath is the third position in this verb pa'al. So that system is used in some textbooks. So if you see a book that's got that system, it's not too difficult to make the transition as long as you recognize that pay represents first position, ayin represents second position, and lamath represents third position. So there'll be ayin guttural verbs, you know, two gutturals, as we've called them. Now, using that same verb, these things are derived. The names for these conjugations are given according to this particular verb in these conjugations. So we see a nifal there, pael, pual, hif'il, hofal, and hithpael. And those are just, and it makes it easy to remember. See, learning these names helps you remember the conjugation. Because if you remember hithpael, you know, I just got to put a hith on the front of it and then change the vowel points to pathak and tseri. And I, you know, if it was kathav, for example, if your verb was kathav, how would it be pronounced in the hithpael form? Okay. Hith kathav. Yeah, hith kathav. Right. It takes a little while to get used to, you know, transferring those over.
Looking at PL.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, PL would be, you know, kathav, you see. And kuthav for pual, and so it's hikvil for orfimi kathav, hikviv for the hithiel. So it's gonna. Sometimes you get your tongue tied up a little bit trying to do this too fast. But if you just think, if you just replace the pe aleph and lamed with the guttural, letters of your the consonants of the verb you're in, have in question, then you'll get the forms. Now, of course, there will be some complications to this and some slight variations and so forth. So we're going to have to look at all those, you know, two, three gutturals, one yos, you know, the whole works for all of this too. So there's going to be complications to that. This is why we are stressing recognition rather than formation of the forms. Unless you were just, you know, doing it from memory and habit, and even then, if you learn the language from habit, you're not even learning conjugations, and you know, you're just learning what word what means what. It's kind of a rote memorization type of thing, just like a little Hebrew child would. But we're trying to understand grammar, so we're trying to look at, really understand these forms. Yes, Bryce?
I'm having trouble. What are the main things, these categories, what are they going to show? We've already got tense, we've got number.
Okay.
Since we've already got
yes.
Some of these
yeah.
So what are they getting?
Well, it has to do kind of a mixture between voice, you know, active, passive, because the nifal, for example, is going to be a passive form of the call, basically. And so the nifals are going to cover what we would call passive, but they'll also get into the middle voice in Greek. They'll be used in middle and passive and so forth and get involved in aspect. And then you have things like pl and pual, which are intensives, and you have hithpil, which is reflexive. You have hithil and hophil, which are causative. And so I would say, as a category, you may have to call it something like, see, they're breaking down different than Greek does. There would be, according to things like aspect and I suppose, you know, aspect would be kind of a general statement about it, but even mood, maybe not so much mood, subjunctive, or, you know, it's not so much that, but it's mainly voice, whether it's active, passive, or middle, and then something like causative, it's hard to describe a category for, or intensive. It's those are quite peculiar Hebrew ideas. The causation idea is done differently in other languages. In Hebrew, it's done with a particular set of morphemes on the verb. So I don't know if anybody's come up with a category for that or not. Usually the books don't even mention it that way.
Would you say then, because it's always categories, Hebrew has more of a chance for precision in your verb?
In a way they do. In a way they do. Well, we've already seen in the general trend that Hebrew tends to be more relying on the context. But when it comes to the verb, there seems to be an awful lot of detail put in a verb. We've already seen endings and suffixes. We're going to see suffixes attached onto the suffixes we've already seen, and now we see this whole set of derived verbs. And what we see, too, is that Hebrew has the ability to take a relatively small total number of verbs and generate a lot more just by putting certain morphemes on, you know.
Understatement.
Yeah, that's a very understatement. So that's I think what is mainly happening. I think that what you may have is the total number of vocabulary roots that you have to learn with Hebrew is less, but the number of forms of the verb is more in the possible positions they can occur. Remember, though, that an average verb that you pick out may not occur in all of those conjugations. That'd probably be the exception rather than rule that it would have all of them. So, and I mean, in actual use, it may have them theoretically, but it may not use them. So, most of the forms you see used in the Hebrew text are going to be call forms. But you're going to see these enough so that it warrants looking at them, and that's why they're put near the end of the book, because they're not as frequently encountered as the others. And then certain verbs, I'd say PLs probably are encountered number two after call. And then maybe nifal. I'm just guessing now, but nifal. And then hithpiles, relatively rare. Hophals, real rare. Fuals, you know, fuals and hophals, the passive forms you see of these intensive ideas are probably more rare. Hithiels is reasonably common. It's a causative idea. That's reasonably common. So we do have to deal with them. I have to know what they...
So what we've got is kind of a combination of things going on. PL, intensive, fuals, the... passive form of the
intensive, right.
If it's causative,
hopeful, passive form of the causative.
If it's intensive.
Yeah, but it's reflexive, intensive, reflexive. So it's doing it yourself. It's kind of, and hithpil, it's interesting because it covers what we often look at as a middle voice in some respects, but actually nifal covers a lot of other of those. And it's used in some peculiar places where there's maybe a motion, a real violent motion, or motion in toward itself. There's, I think there's a discussing the flames and so forth of the cherubim and the sword and the flames. Over there's a hithpile verb form that's real interesting, but we'll get into that. They have a lot of fun with some of these verbs, especially hithpiles, and we're going to see some other strange features about hithpiles too. Sometimes they'll reverse the tau will swap places with the first letter in the verb, especially if it's a sheen or something. So you'll see something like hishtael or something, and the tau and the sheen swap places, and that If a person sees that the first time, what is going on? It looks like the right pattern, but those letters are out of order. And they'll do that sometimes. So, and so you try to look it up under tile or something, it's not there. It's under shile or something. You know, it's, well, I'm giving you the worst of it now. I'm just kind of giving you hints of as to what's happening here. Okay, let's start with niphal then, niphal verbs. First, the meaning of niphal. Broadly speaking, niphal verbs characterized by an element nun prefixed to the root are medial passive in meaning. Now, medial means middle. It's got the idea of middle, so it's middle passive. So for the Greek students that are familiar with passive forms and middle forms, this is kind of a, covers both, medial passive in meaning. Because a theoretical discussion of this term, by no means consistently employed in grammatical descriptions, would take us too far afield, we shall categorize these verbs on the basis of their translation value in English. So we're going to see four categories of possible translation values for niphal verb forms. Now, you might let your eyes run now to the very bottom of page 177 for the bottom line on this. And this is the bottom line. Only a careful study of the context will enable the reader to decide among the various possibilities. Okay? So we've got four possibilities here, but this doesn't mean that you're going to know for sure and dogmatically which one it is. These are the four kinds of translations, and context is going to have to be the guide to deciding which one it is. They've all got certain things in common, but they're, you know, they're different. So let's look. First one, incomplete passive. Now, by incomplete passive, we mean a passive in which the agent is unstated. Now, remember, again, reminding the Greek students, where in Greek, when you have a passive sentence construction, how is an agent indicated there?
Oh.
Yeah, hypo plus the genitive. So the agent will be stated most of the time. Although in Greek, you can sometimes say the book was read and not say by whom. And that would be an incomplete passive, according to this, where the agent is not stated. It's still passive construction, but the agent wasn't stated. And that's what we see in Hebrew. The passive in English is a construction, not a category of verbal meaning. Of course, in English, we do it with auxiliary verbs and so forth, so we don't have a conjugation for the passive. If a verb occurs in an active transitive usage, such as the students read the lesson, there is a passive transformation to the corresponding, the lesson was read by the students. And so in English, what we do is we take the thing that was the direct object, namely lesson here, put that as the subject, convert the verb from active to passive. Instead of saying read, we say was read. And then we indicate the agent by a prepositional phrase, by the students. And so we've converted an active sentence to a passive sentence that way. In Greek, the same thing basically is done, except you're using nominative and accusative cases, and then, nominative case, taking the accusative, putting it in the nominative, and then transforming the verb into passive, and then putting hypo plus the genitive to indicate. It's quite analogous to what English does. Now, by the incomplete passive, we mean the same transformation minus the agent. The lesson was read. Now, you cut the agent off, and you know that the lesson was read, but you don't know by whom. The use of which indicates that the speaker is not concerned with specifying the agent of the action. All Hebrew passives belong to this category. So Hebrew is not going to have passive constructions that indicate the agent. They just don't say it that way. If they want to show you who the agent is, they'll put it in an active. So that's kind of an interesting feature. It's funny, there's lots of things that Hebrew doesn't have, but you never miss them, because they always seem to get their thought expressed anyway. But it just doesn't do this. Constructions with a specified agent are virtually non-existent. If the corresponding call verb is active transitive, it is always possible to translate the niphal verb as an incomplete passive. So, if you've got a call verb that's an active transitive verb, in other words, it can take a direct object, then you can always form, or at least you can make the niphal, and one of the possibilities for the translation of the niphal will be this incomplete passive. Now, if the verb does not have a passive idea, if the verb is intransitive, doesn't take an object, then you can't, you may have a niphal, but it won't be translated this way. It won't be translated as an incomplete passive. Okay, here's some examples to compare the two. Kathav et hadavar, for a call sentence, which would mean he wrote the word. And then niktav hadavar, the word was written. And of course, we don't know by whom now, because they're not expressing the agent. The word was written.
Of course, we do know what's happening.
Well, yes, but that only applies to the word. See, now the word is the subject of that. Niktav hadavar, the word was written. So your subject's going to be the word now. So whatever that is what's going to determine it. So you can see the next example here with Ir. Azav es ha'ir, he abandoned the city. Then you can have ne'ezva ha'ir, ne'ezva. And that's the nifal form with the feminine ending, you see. That's third person feminine singular because ha'ir is feminine. Okay. And harag es ha'ish, he slew the man. If you just want to say the man was slain, that would be neherag ha'ish. And now the man is the subject of that. The man was slain. Yes.
I'm sorry, I must be confused. Are you saying that the sentence that's translated here is translated the same for both of those Hebrew phrases, or does it?
No. No, he just, okay. Yeah, the translation only fits the Nifal. The call was only put there to show you what that was transformed from. But it would be a different translation, of course. Maybe for your own benefit, over on the other side of the call, you could put the translation. The first sentence would be, he wrote the word. The second sentence would be, he abandoned the city. And the third sentence would be, he slew the man. And now, converting into passive, they don't express the agent. So the passive form isn't really going to be an exact meaning the same as the other, just passivized. You're going to lose the agent out of it, see, because Hebrew won't express the agent.
Right.
You see, and what I'm saying is, in that first example, if kathav et hadavar means he wrote the word, then to get a totally passive concept there and get the full expression, you would have to say the word was written by him. But in Hebrew, they don't have the by him part. They never express the agent. They just don't do it. So that's why this isn't an accurate. It's not really a translation or a total transformation of the previous one, because the agent's dropped out. But it's just you doing it to illustrate that Nifal is used that way.
The actual correct translation would be to include the agent in it.
No, it wouldn't be the translation of the Hebrew Nifal here. Let's put it this way. The English, the word was written, he wrote the word, in English would be transformed by this phrase, the word was written by him. And in English we would use an agent. But it's hard in Hebrew because active forms are by definition going to have an agent there, the subject. So whether it's he, whether it's a pronoun, or whether it's nominal, you know, like the man or something like that, it's going to have a subject. And so when you make a passive transformation from a Hebrew active phrase to a passive, because the passive never expresses the subject, you're going to lose some information in the process. They just don't do it that way. And so, but there are some times when you may, in English or in Greek or in any other language, when you may be speaking and not wanting to tell, to express the agent, not wanting to say who did the action, just that the action was done. And in those instances, you can use a passive form, and Hebrew can do that too, and just not say anything about the agent. That's what we call an incomplete passive, that the agent isn't expressed. So Hebrew can do that, but Hebrew can't do a complete passive where you've got the agent expressed. Just can't do it. Or very rarely.
So then you're expecting that somewhere in there you already have who you're
talking. You might from context, or you might for purposes of secrecy or something like that, or there may be a reason sometimes to say, if you're talking to somebody and you want to say that a certain action was done, but you don't want to say who did it, you know, just say, this was, say the pastor is wanting to, give some correction on a letter that he got and so forth. You can just say, this letter was received, was received by, I guess that's not really quite right. Maybe he's talking about some action that was performed, something, somebody did this, this was done, this action was done, and he doesn't want to say by whom. So he just said it was done. And it's not important who did it, it was just done. And so now, these are the consequences. So there may be occasions because of protection, or because of, sometimes it's not even that. Sometimes it's the narrative is concerned only with the fact that the action was completed, and now what do we do? Not with who did it and assigning blame or anything else. It's happened. Now what do we do? Or they're just focusing on the fact that something was done as a result of something else building on it, and you're not even looking at the rest of at the agent. Kind of like the aorist in Greek, and not exactly, of course, but sometimes you're only concerned with the fact that the action was done, not the manner in which it was done. In this case, you're concerned with the fact that the action was done, not who did it. Okay? Now, you're not going to see passives real frequently in Hebrew anyway. So, and when you do, it'll be incomplete passives like this. They tend to speak actively, you know, tell it just like it is, not beat around the bush.
And the nifal doesn't show up that often?
No, it's not going to show up as, it's going to show up, but it's not going to show up real frequently. And when it does show up, there's some other possibilities for its translation besides that. That's just one of four categories of the way it may be used. The next category is the middle voice. Middle verbs in English are elusive because they pattern like active verbs and have the same form. So in English, we don't have a distinction between middle forms and active forms. We do make a distinction in passive forms, but not in middle. Now, Greek does a little bit of both. In some tenses, there's a distinction between active and middle, and between passive and middle. And in some, like the present tense, you've got middle passive form. In other words, the form is the same for both middle and passive, and you have to use context to decide. But Greek does have middle forms, and Hebrew here has this nifal, which can also be middle. It can be passive or middle. And context has to decide. So an active, here to get the idea of a middle, he broke the window would be active. The window broke would be middle. Because there, the window receives the action, of course, so the window's also, the thing that's breaking. It's not really performing the action, but it certainly involves somehow. It's the thing that's doing the breaking, but it's also hurt because of it, as it were. In other words, it's receiving the action and, in a sense, performing the action. Although there may be another agent that may be having somebody that did the actual breaking of the window. But sometimes all you see is that the window broke, or the car stopped. He stopped the car. The car stopped. The car stopped. Now, to say the car stopped is sometimes said because we don't know who's driving it. If you're out in the street and the car pull up and stop. Well, we don't really mean by saying that the car is a little robot of its own, and it's got its own mind and it's doing initiating action. And yet that's the way the action appears to us. And so we know that there's somebody behind the wheel of the car that's actually doing it, but the action that we're seeing is the car is actually doing this. But the car is, in a sense, receiving an action and performing an action. It's stopping, it's performing the action, but it's doing it as a result of someone else manipulating it. Or the door opened, same thing. Doors don't open by themselves. There's people that open doors. But we saw the door open. It's kind of a mix between an active and a passive idea. The door is receiving an action, but it's also being pictured as performing an action if the one who did the opening isn't in view. So that's one use, and that's one way a middle voice can be used too. This is only one of several ideas of the middle voice. The next one is this reflexive that we'll talk about a little bit later on. So unlike the incomplete passive construction, middle verbs are active in form, but the meaning, that is the voice, is in a sense reversed. The object of the active verb has become the subject of the middle verb. So instead of the window was broken, or he broke the window, which was an object, now the window broke. You're putting that as the subject of it, but you're still using an active form for the verb. The window broke, as if the window performed an action. The window isn't really performing the action, it's receiving the action, but the construction is set up as though it performed it. So that's a good place. It's like one and it's like the other, so they call it middle. It's in between. That's where the idea of middle comes from. Okay, nifal verbs in Hebrew often correspond to middle verbs in English. And so it might be passive or it might be middle. So and you have to kind of look at what the subject is and the meanings of the words to decide whether you're going to call it middle or passive. For example, in this first example, niftach hasha'ar, hasha'ar, the gate opened. Okay, it's pretty good, you can't really make that a passive. Well, I suppose you could say the gate was opened, so you might have a choice there, either the gate opened or the gate was opened, and you'd have to kind of go by the context and so forth to decide which way to render that. Same with the vessel broke or the vessel was broken or the people gathered. That when the people gathered, the people were gathered, that might be, if somebody else is coming to gather the people, but the context may show that the people did it of their own volition. The people gathered. In that case, you'd have to translate it middle because there isn't anybody that's gathering them. So sometimes it's just the meaning and the setting and so forth that's going to determine whether you're going to go with a middle or a passive idea. Okay, then there's an additional option. That's reflexive. Reflexive verbs in English have an expressed object, the reflexive pronoun, which refers to the subject. So in English, we do it with a reflexive pronoun. We take the subject, and if it's pronominal or even if it's nominal, and we put a pronoun that represents that subject as the direct object. So here, he saw himself in the water. So he is the subject, saw is the verb, and himself is the direct object. But the himself is connected back to he, because, you know, he and him, you see. And the self ties it right back to the same one. So in English, we do it with a reflexive pronoun. The Greek students know that Greek does that with a middle voice form. And Hebrew is going to do that. One way to do that is with niphal. Even more precise way to do it is with hithpael, which we'll get to later on. That's a real clear reflexive. But he washed himself, he sold himself into slavery. These would all have this reflexive idea, and sometimes niphals will be translated that way. So nig'al, for example, could be he redeemed himself. He redeemed himself. Okay. Yes.
Therefore, that up there in the niphal, it says the man with flame. There are things that the man moved up. And that example under the niphal, which says
Oh yes, right. That's another possibility. Yeah, the man slew himself, or the man was slain. You wouldn't have a middle point, this other, the way he categorized middle, this number two category, that wouldn't work there. But it, either the reflexive or the passive would work there. Yeah, you're still gonna have to rely on the context. And then this other one, this resultative idea. Is even more, a little bit more nebulous than the other three. More important, if it's more important, see, more important than either of the two preceding categories is the niphal verb in a resultative meaning. Essentially, a stative verb, the resultative niphal, describes the state of its subject, which has been produced by the verbal action named by the root. Okay, look at the comparison here. We have active, pathak, to open, but a passive, niftak, to be opened, or a resultative niftach, to be open. We're dealing with making a stative idea almost out of the active form. And so we do have stative verbs, but then we can also take active verbs and make them into a stative idea by this niphal. And again, niftach here, in both cases, passive and resultative, the form is exactly the same. So the only way you're going to be able to tell is by context, to be opened or to be open. It's kind of, see, to be open is the result of being opened. Once you've been opened, you're open, and you abide in the state of being open. And they'll use the niphal apparently to describe this state of being open as well as the state of being opened. So you have to look at the context again to see whether the focus is on the result of the action or whether it's on the action itself. So to break, to be broken, and to be broken, or to be in pieces, to be in the state of being broken, you see. It's a subtle distinction. In English, the equivalent of the resultative is so often formally the same as the passive that the distinction made here is difficult to grasp. In the passive, it was broken, was is an auxiliary verb, and in the unit was broken. In the resultative, it was broken, was is the verb to be, followed by an adjective or participle. One can see this difference most clearly by applying, for example, a transformation into present real. A passive, it is being broken, or the resultative, it is broken. So if you transform it into a present real, in other words, a progressive action in the present, it is being broken. If you put the being in there, you can see that it's focusing on the action. And if you just say it is broken, it's focusing on the result. So sometimes you have to make a distinction along those lines. But unfortunately, English doesn't always do that. Sometimes it'll say it is broken, to be talking about the action, you know. If you want clarification, though, in English, we will often make this distinction ourselves. We'll put the verb to be in there and get a progressive idea so we don't confuse it with the resultant state. So, in other words, if somebody's breaking something, you know, and we want to make sure that we're saying it is in the process of being broken, we'll say that rather than say it is broken, meaning it's all finished. Okay, this is probably one of the most subtle ones. But again, just consider it as one of the options and possibilities for translating the niphal. Is the bell ring yet?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
You go ahead and sign what you want done.
Yeah, I'll give you what you want, or what I want you to do, and the rest of this is going to be looking at the form, so we'll probably be into this tomorrow. So for Part A, do number one. Part A here, number one, number five, number nine, 13, and 17. And there's a typo error on 17. There should be a comma under that first yod. Otherwise, you've got no vowel point on it. But put a comma under there and you'll be all right. Then on Part B, do the odd numbered ones. That'll be 1, 3, and 5 for Part B. C, the reading is all of that. As always. Oh, yes, yeah. I guess for next week, Tuesday we'll take the quiz. Yeah, we'll get that out of the way first. What I would say is if you're pressed for time, you maybe take a glance at these first ones. We'll just see, it's going to take us a while to get through. We'll probably only have enough time to go through our test quiz and then do this, finish this chapter out, go through the vocabulary, maybe get started with these just verbally. So don't worry about trying to prepare. Focus on the test. And then we'll just have to work this other in between there. Break will be not next week, but the week following. And we got what, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday off, right? So we'll lose 2 days in this class. Okay. In section A, do 1, 5, 9, 13, 17. No. No, I didn't mark that one. I guess I was going every other odd one. So starting with 1, skip 3, then 5, skip 7, then 9, skip 11, then 13, skip 15, then 17. What's that? Oh, okay. What it means is to put in the vowel points, I think. Let me see. Oh, yes, that's right. That's the reason there was no... Yeah, he didn't give the full punctuation. You need to fill in the vowel points on the nifal verbs involved. Yeah, I guess I gave you the one on 17. That's all right. I must have looked at that later on and just noticed that one wasn't...